In other words, when a person fears losing something, what they're fearing is realizing that they do not need it to be happy and will get along well without it. When a person fears losing something, what they are fearing is realizing that they do not need it to be happy and will get along without it. They are fearing that when they realize they don't need it, that they might not want it, since it is an apparently good thing to have, that thing. They fear it. They fear that they will not want what is good for them. And this can be a terrifying realization for someone. This generally happens in childhood. Our first practices of this. For instance, as a child grows up and begins to see that they really do not need their parents as they used to, they often become very afraid of their parents dying. This fear is often expressed as a desire to die first before the parent. The real reason is that most of their wanting of their parents, up to that point, anything they've ever wanted of their parents, has been based on needing them. So even simple wants are often expressed as needs in their relationship. I need you to feed me. I need you to allow me to go out to play, to stay up late, etc. And the parent does their best to encourage and reward this belief that they are needed for just about everything. Okay, so that when a child begins to realize that they don't need their parents, that becomes tantamount to saying, I have no longer any excuse for wanting anything from them. Anytime I've ever wanted things, it's been I've needed them. A child has been almost incapable of wanting something from a parent that hasn't actually been only the domain of the parent to grant. So that if you're wanting something from only one source, from the only source possible to get that from, it's easy to see that source as needed for the thing you want. Therefore needed for your happiness.
Did you make the original statement again?
That when a person fears losing something, what they're fearing is realizing that they don't need it. So that when the child fears losing his parents, the child is afraid that the parents will die, let's say. What they're afraid of is realizing that they really do not need their parents in order to be happy. And they don't want to believe that. They don't need their parents. They're in trouble. Because parents also want the belief encouraged that they're needed for just about everything.
Why?
For the very same reasons that started in their childhood. That one is needed, it's good to be needed, etc. Well, parents don't want to believe that they don't need their children either.
All right, that's another part of it. But in working with teenagers' parents, that need for control is the most important thing that they have, because once they lose that, they feel that they've lost everything.
Well, that's the same with a child. They're afraid that once they lose their need for their parent and their control of them thereby, they've lost everything too.
Then I won't be able to teach them the right way to behave and to react.
I think that all of your reasons are true, and everything that you're saying is absolutely accurate. What I'm talking about is the underlying dynamic that's behind all of that is also on their point. They are afraid, when they're afraid of losing something, for instance, their control over their children, the same phenomenon will be taking place. When you're afraid of losing something, it's because you're afraid of knowing that you could be happy without it. And they don't want to know that they could be happy without control. They wouldn't want to believe that. In the extreme, just about every time that the child wants something that they perceive that they can only receive from their parents, they will choose to need it and express it as a need, even a new toy. You know, and the child may even cry if he doesn't get it. The child will act as if they need the new toy. The child will cry and thereby acknowledge that the parents, by crying, they're acknowledging the parents' belief that they are needed by the child. And that their denial is capable of making the child unhappy. The child has well learned that unless he plays the game with his parents and continues to encourage them to believe that he needs them, what is liable to happen? If you live with people who will not give you anything unless they believe you need it, what are you going to, you think you're going to get anything? And if you're an infant and you piss in your pants, do you think anybody would care if you didn't cry? And if you were hungry, do you think anybody would care if you didn't make a stink about it? Etc. You quickly come to perceive that nobody really gives a damn about you except as you bother them. It doesn't take much for a child to come to that realization. The sound of the original cry was just simply one of communication. Subsequent months of the infant's existence, that cry changes and becomes a cry of pain and a cry of need, which wasn't there in the first place. And so a parent assumes that the child is crying, the child is therefore unhappy. And it is almost a universal belief that all children who are crying are unhappy. They're unhappy that they're hungry. They're unhappy that they're not unhappy. What are they going to do, write you a letter? How else do they tell you that they want to eat? You know, type it out on a typewriter? Whistle? They do what they're biologically capable of doing, and that's making sounds from their mouths that we call crying. So the child in doing that, as a later child, acknowledges the parent's belief and says, see, I believe as you believe. We have the same religion. I do need you. You see? Now, will you feed me? I do need you. Now, will you give me a toy? I really do need you. I mean, can you imagine a child that asked for a toy and the parents said no and they just walked away happily? You think that kid would ever get another toy? Knowing most parents? Hardly. He doesn't need toys. And there's also, you know, when the child lets the parent know that they are needed by the child, that the child needs them, and that their denial is really capable of making the child unhappy, there has to be, and there is, a secret joy of power in making one's child cry. Especially to the degree that the parent needs to be needed. And so that every time a child will cry, the parent has got to feel glad to be needed. It was one of their motives, in fact, in having a child. They wanted somebody to need them. Now, depending on how guilty the parent is about that secret joy that they feel, now they can get awfully guilty about that. Feeling happy that your child is crying can be seen to be a contradiction to some people. And I guess it depends on the amount of guilt that they'll feel. They'll either be a parent who doesn't feel guilt at that joy, or in fact doesn't feel much of that joy, could really be very firm in their denial, and they could see it as a rational and suitable thing. No, you cannot play with matches, and no, you cannot play with the razor blades, and no, you can't go out and play in the street, etc. And somehow they'll feel really okay about that, and there's no secret joy in the child's crying. And even if there was, the joy of like, oh, my child cries and therefore needs me and will pay attention and do what I want, and he'll be unhappy that I don't, you know, etc., so I can really control him and keep him safe that way. But there could even be more guilt, and so then the child may have to react to berating the child for being childish. Apparently, the worst thing any parent can say to a child is that you're being childish. You just simply accuse them of being who they are, and that's the biggest put-down somehow. Always to make a child grow up. You say, oh, you don't want to be a baby. It's you know, what, a year old, 2 years old, you're saying you don't want to be a baby. So you can berate the child for being a child, for being childish, or you could even acquiesce and give the child everything it asks for because you want to be needed as a loving parent who is needed, because you really need to be seen as a loving parent who is needed. Okay, now, that's kind of where it begins in childhood. But you could see now, in your older life, the fear of losing a friend. Let's just take that one. Is the fear of finding out you don't need that friend for you to be happy. If you fear losing a friend, what you're really fearing is finding out that you don't need that friend in order to be happy. If you fear losing money, if you fear being poor, what you fear is realizing that you don't need things to be happy. The things that money buys you. You don't need them to be happy, and you wouldn't want to know that. You don't want to know that. You're scared shit of finding that out. So what you do is you become afraid of being poor, because if you became poor, you'd find that out, wouldn't you? Health is the same thing. You could be afraid of losing your health, because you don't want to know that if you were not healthy, you could be happy. You could be afraid of being stupid, because you don't want to know that you could be happy without being smart. In other words, I'm afraid of not being loved, because I believe I need to be happy. But I believe I need to be happy because I'm afraid of seeing I don't need it. Because then I believe, I think this is what you want to know, CK, because I'm afraid of seeing I don't need it, because then I believe I might not want it. Because if I do not want it, because then I might believe I might not want it, because I do want it. And I'm afraid of not wanting it because I do want it. But if I don't need it, I might not want it because there is something wrong with me. Because how do I know there's something wrong with me? Because I'm afraid of not being loved. And I know I don't need it. And yet I'm afraid of not being loved. And deep down inside, I know I don't need it in order to be happy. So there must be something wrong with me for needing something I don't need. Now, if I can need something I don't need, I could also want something I don't want. Or not want something I do want, because I really don't need it. And so since I don't really need anything, I could want what I don't want, not want what I do want it, not want it. My God, I could go crazy. You see, if I don't need anything, how do I order my life? How do I want what I want? In other words, if I'm afraid of not learning, because it seems that I believe that I need to learn in order to change, and get more of what I want or need. And I need to learn in order to change to get more of what I want or need. And I believe that because I believe that I would be unhappy if I saw that I don't need to learn in order to be happier. And if I saw that I don't need to learn because in order to be happier, I'd be unhappy about that because I've always believed that what was wrong with me was that I didn't learn well. And that it was hard for me to change, etc. And that, you know, I was somehow thick. And if I believe that I don't need to learn and could still be happy, then I might not have any motivation to learn if I wanted to. Because what is wrong with me is that I don't learn what and when I want. Because I believe that I have always wanted to learn. Because I've always wanted to learn, I know that. Because how do I know that? Because I've always been unhappy about not learning. And that, I believe, is the same thing as wanting to learn. Because I believe that if I was not unhappy about the possibility of not learning, then it would mean I don't want to learn. And since I want to, I don't want to know that I could be happy if I didn't learn. Then there would be something wrong with me. Because if I could be happy not having what I want, I might not want it enough to do, and there would really be something wrong with me. It's a very long sentence, but it basically keeps saying the same thing. You have to keep believing that there's something wrong with you, and this is it. What's wrong with me is that I don't have enough freedom. See, that's what's wrong with me. That's why I'm unhappy. That's why I'm the kind of person I am. What's wrong with me is that I don't have enough mobility. What's wrong with me is I don't have enough success. What's wrong with me is I don't have enough money. What's wrong with me is that I'm stupid. I'm thick. I don't learn very well. I don't change very easily. That's what's wrong with me. What's wrong with me is I'm lazy. What's wrong with me is I'm unkind, I'm unloving, I'm selfish. That's what's wrong with me. Aha, see, that's what's wrong with me. I know what's wrong with me. I'm not loved. I know I'm afraid of being alone. What's wrong with me is that I'm weak-willed. Now, I don't want to know that this is not what is wrong with me. And that I could be happy without this. I don't want to know that. For all the reasons that I stated before. This has to be what's wrong with me. In other words, when I fear losing something, what I'm really fearing is realizing that I don't need it to be happy. What you're saying you believe is possible is I want to know what it feels like to be decapitated, and then I want to go out to dinner. But you don't want its irrevocableness.
No, it's not that. It's maybe I would want its irrevocableness, but why not have all of this first?
Why not?
And then it's irrevocable.
Can you want that? Want to have all of this first and then the irrevocableness?
Yeah.
Stay in touch with that. That's your greatest safety. Want all of this first. Stop not wanting all of this first. The only reason you stop not wanting all of this first is because you become afraid. And you get unhappy. And you want to get away from some of this.
Now what happens when I'm happy? That's what scares me.
Yes, but with that happiness, there must be some fear. He says, what happens when I'm happy and I'm scared? That happiness is a lot of it, or enough of it, is that you're glad to be done with the things that you've been afraid of, and you're afraid of that. And there is that fear there. You want to get away from the things that you've been believing in. You see, when you're happy, you're away from the things that make you unhappy.
That makes sense, except that it doesn't.
It's not true.
Feel that way. It feels like I might want that more, that whatever it is that I've never known.
What do you want more? First this, then the irrevocableness?
All of that.
Why would you want the irrevocableness after if you know you can have it, if you know you're going to have it someday?
Yeah.
Why would you want it first?
Part of it is that I don't know that it's irrevocable. I fear that it might be.
Do you have to fear that it might be? Why can't you just say, I suppose it might be, or it might be?
Yeah.
It might be irrevocable. So that anything you believe might be irrevocable, whether it is or not, is not the point. Mm-hmm. How can you want that first? As long as you know you want
this.
Because
I know this isn't irrevocable. Yeah.
So that you can always want this first.
Yeah.
And let that come
save
in its time.
Save irrevocability for last.
Right,
for whenever.
Right. Save death for last. If you're even talking about death, save death for last. Sure, since you know you can always have it, since you believe it may be yours, then why not have everything else first? Right, sort of like it's having, would you want the orgasm before sex? I mean that. How many of you would have sex if the orgasm came first?
I might.
That's, of course, you would fear that.
Well, which came first?
I might figure it could be okay either way. I don't know.
But knowing, what I'm saying is that after the orgasm, a lot of what felt good before the orgasm is not going to feel as good after. If you can have the best of both, why wouldn't you put them in the order that gave you the best of both? See?
What would be the best of both?
When? Everything but the last. If you put the last anywhere but last, that becomes the end. So the last will always be last, and it depends on when do you want it last.
Yeah.
You can't juggle last. If you put last in the middle,
but isn't just
then
last,
the
isn't
next
last
half
what
is
you
gone.
Do after everything else?
Right. family. But it's irrevocable. Last is not necessarily what you do after everything else. Last is after which you do nothing.
Is last defined by what you do before it, or the fact that you do nothing after it?
The fact that you do nothing after it.
And how do you ever know at what point you is going to do nothing?
So, since you don't know, you don't do what might be last. And save it for last and find out. Does the executed man want his last meal before or after he's executed? Usually they want it before. Somehow there's a natural order there. And we can trust ourselves for that, perhaps. And I think the only thing that would put this doubt in your mind is that an avoidance of what's here, not a seeking after what's irrevocable. Only to the degree that you're seeking the irrevocable, it's to the degree that you're avoiding and escaping, wanting what's here.
Somehow, I guess I'm not so afraid I'm going to give up my wanting. I'm afraid I'm not going to attend to my wanting while I'm wanting something else.
My only answer to you is that although you say you know that you've wanted to be healthy, I say to you that because you're unhappy, you're lying. That an unhappy person lies even when they're telling the truth. And so sure you want to be healthy, but you don't really want to be healthy. You're more concerned with being unhappy about being unhealthy, you see? And you're more concerned with being afraid of being unhealthy, and you're thinking that's the same as wanting to be healthy. So to the degree that you're unhappy, to that degree you may be considering and believing that wanting not to be unhealthy is the same as wanting to be healthy. And so you may not really be wanting to be healthy. In terms of what motivates you, you're not wanting it. In terms of who you are, in your depth of your being, your real self, you really do want to be healthy. But don't you see this only proves that we really want to be happier more than we want to be healthy? You see, that's why a human being can get into these difficulties, because we are not concerned with survival like other animals are. To survive is not enough. We have come to believe that we can survive better by being unhappy, and so then decide, hey, I think I'd rather not survive so well and be a little happier. And we will turn to things that, even though they destroy our health, will make us happier. You know, how do you account for drug addicts and alcoholics and, you know, and the good feeling getters? The desire has to be there first, right, in order for you to have the fear that you won't do it. But when you're in touch with wanting to be healthy, you are becoming healthier. You are tending toward health. When you're wanting to be healthy, you're not going to do things to be unhealthy. You can only do things that would be unhealthy when you're wanting something else. And perhaps, at the same time, you know, not wanting to be unhealthy.
But when you're really wanting to be healthy, are you really ever in touch with that?
Exactly. If you were happy and you were moving toward being healthy, you don't need to. Like,
then you wouldn't be in touch with it, actually, unless someone said,
in a sense, right, exactly.
You'd be like in touch with it.
Are you wanting, at this moment, are you wanting to be wearing that beautiful thing?
Now that you ask me, yes.
But?
But I wasn't thinking of it.
Yes, and yet there's no doubt that you've been wanting it, because you were doing it.
Right.
And when you're doing it and tending toward it. Now, before you put it on, when there was a question, then you could want it or not. And wanting is only in terms of when there's still a question about it. And it's at that time that you could not want it. And how does it always keep coming to be a question? That I want to be healthy. Because my unhappiness has led me away from it. That something that I have wanted has been exactly opposite to it. And then, so that the way to get back, it depends on where you're coming from, right? So if you're not there and you're not tending towards your health, when you're realizing that you're wanting to, that's all you need to do. And that's it. Now you want to again. And that's all. That never will be contradicted until you actually contradict it. That will always be in play. CK, if you want to be healthy, that will stay in play. That will continue to be so, until you contradict it by wanting something else when you want not to be unhappy. And if there's something you want in order not to be unhappy that contradicts your health, you'll choose that if you believe you need it to not be unhappy, to save you from your unhappiness, if it be, you know, whatever, cigarettes, drugs. We're never in touch with wanting what we have, unless, you know, it's brought to
us. So being in touch with the wanting is actually a kind of turning point.
It's just changing your mind, that's all it means to, right? So when a person fears losing something, what they are fearing is realizing that they don't need it to be happy. So can you see what the tremendous natural resistance to any kind of an option statement would be, or an option message would be? Can you see why it would bring out the greatest insanity and fears of people if you told people they didn't have to be? If anything you say during your session even implies that they needn't be unhappy without this, if it even implies it, that they, you know, as we said, you shouldn't be unhappy.
Some people object at the very first and most basic option statements. I mean, not even in a session.
Well, that's why there shouldn't be any statements.
In classes, you know.
Well, that's why there should be no option statements, period.
Well, there were even implied statements in questions.
Only for the hearer.
That's only for the hearer.
Not really.
I ask questions that I imply absolutely no statements about. To do with that is just ask Kristen, why do you believe you really want to?
Well, she would always say, well, I must, I'm doing it.
So you've deduced it. You deduce that you want to. No, you'll find that. It's a deduction.
Yeah.
And it becomes enough to point out that it's a deduction. Say, okay, you're deducing that. That's one answer that you're deducing. What about the possibility that you're doing it because you believe you have to, rather than wanting it? Now, for us, at a later stage, we see that believing that you have to and wanting it are the same thing. If you can see this, that when people are afraid of losing, that what they're afraid of is realizing that they don't need it, that they're more afraid of that than anything else, and that's behind the fear of losing, etc., then you can see why there can be no option statements, except to people who have already worked through that fear and are not afraid of that, who are not afraid of seeing that they do want and they do choose to be unhappy, and that, you know, that they are choosing it somehow, who are understanding that somehow their choices are mistakes, but nonetheless made in good faith, you know, somewhere. Because what a person is most afraid of hearing is that somehow they're not acting in their own best interest, or they're not acting through good intentions, or something, that everything that's wrong with them is that they don't take care of themselves, or that they're not acting from the best intentions. That would be one of those, you know, lists of, oh, this is what is wrong with me. What is wrong with me is that I screw myself all the time. That's what's wrong. That I want things that are bad for me. And work out all the correlations, for instance, the simple Freudian correlations that a person can only fear what they desire. The other correlations that we've talked about before, how if you fear a thing enough, you run headlong into it in order to relieve the fear, in order to relieve the anxiety. Because somehow wanting to prove
that you don't need it,
in order to be happy at the same time, and being afraid of seeing that you don't need it in order to be happy. So then believing you have to force yourself, that the only way to see that you don't need it in order to be happy is to actually make it happen and deprive yourself and then live through it. And then, of course, since you're doing it with that fear, you live through it miserably and unhappily too. You know?
I'm working with a
father, but knowing that you'll get over it eventually.
I'm working with a father who turned his son out. And he won't let him back in, just for that reason. Because then he'll have to deal with all the unhappiness again. And this way, the thing that he feared most was the kid leaving. Now that the kid's gone, and he's dealt with it in his own unhappy way, at least that's a reality.
I have never known two lovers to split up for any other reason.
Because they feared it so much that they had to do it in order to prove themselves.
I've never seen two people who got divorced for any other reason. There may be other reasons, but they're not the ones I've ever come across. What I hope to cover this evening will be in three parts. The first part I'll discuss now. And then later, we'll have an exercise regarding it, and after that, a discussion of and an exploration of cases regarding this that I'll share with you, and a method for dealing with it. The topic I'm dealing with is I've called relationship counseling. So you could see that as either marriage counseling, or family counseling, or couples counseling, however, generally in any relationship. I've subtitled it Loving and Wanting to Love. And I think you'll see later, I think the confusion between those two is the basis of much of the difficulty in relationships. When two or more people are unhappy with each other, it may manifest itself in these ways. Generally, I find that it breaks down to these basic two ways. One, the obvious, is that they're unhappy that they're not getting what they expect from the other. That one of the parties, or both, are unhappy that they're not getting what they should from the other, which is another way of saying that they're not getting what they believe they need. Okay, so those three terms are kind of interchangeable. They're not getting what they expect, or they're not getting what they should, they're not getting what they believe they need. And that will usually regard, that will break down into two different spheres. A, regarding functions and things from that other person, or B, good feelings, such as approval, love, happy with me, etc. Okay, do you understand that? So that the first part is one of the ways it's manifested, that a person is unhappy that they're not getting what they expect, should, or believe they need from the other. And that usually has two forms. That they're not getting functions and things, some kind of material, solid function, practical, something practical, or good feelings, such as approval, love, happy with me, whatever. The second way that it manifests itself is unhappy about not being or not giving what one should to the other. Okay, so that's the unhappiness about not being what one should, quote-unquote, be for the other, or what one expects oneself to be, or what is expected to be, or etc. And that also regards A, functions and things, or B, good feelings, etc. Now, regarding this second person, I just want to add that this is the person who ultimately will leave the relationship. Always, in my experience, I have found that when anyone leaves the relationship, it's that second one. Even if the other feeling has predominated, even if the first feeling has predominated, that they're not getting what they want, you know, and that constantly that has predominated, there will be a point when that feeling converts to the second feeling, which is the feeling that they're not giving what they should and they're not being what they should. And it's when that feeling becomes strong that the person leaves the relationship. Both are feelings of powerlessness, I think you can see. That the first case, the person believes and experiences that they have no power to motivate the other to give. In the second case, they believe they have no power to motivate themselves to give. But in either case, it's a feeling of powerlessness. Each is using the other, or expecting the other, however you want to put it, to affirm their worth. That's basically what's going on in either case. Basically, the feelings go like this. It usually starts off with this one cardinal belief upon which everything else hinges. If you loved me, you would X. Okay? From that starts all the difficulties in relationships. If you loved me, you would. Now, we'll take a closer look at that sentence later. It's got a number of inherent contradictions and pitfalls. In some ways, it's really an impossible sentence. In some ways, it's really an impossible feeling to have. But nonetheless, that's the experience of people who have problems in their relationships. If you loved me, you would. Since you don't do this or feel that or be this way, X, it's because you don't love me enough. Why don't you love me enough? I do this and that and that and that, and I do all of those things, etc. Why don't you love me enough? Why isn't who I am what I do? Why isn't that enough for you to love me more? Then the reasoning continues. Why can't I get you to love me more? And it's a question, but the answer is often implied. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you that I can't get you to love me more? Now that I'm thinking of it, what's wrong with me? Becomes the immediate corollary. I'm unhappy that you have made me feel that there's something wrong with me. By your actions, by your behavior, by what you do, etc. You've made me feel that there's something wrong with you, with me. You've made me feel that there's something wrong with me. I'm unhappy that you have made me feel that there is something so wrong with me that I can't get the only and the simplest thing that I want, which is for you to be happier with me and to love me more. That's all I want. Now, of course, I want to interject at this point, of course the feeling was not caused by the other, but again by that first premise and its implications, if you loved me more. So starting by that, whenever the person isn't doing, etc., you don't need anything else. In fact, this can be totally unspoken between a person and another person. In other words, I could just observe Wendy's sitting there with a cigarette in her mouth, and she's sitting with her legs crossed, and she's writing that, and I could just say to myself, totally within me, if she loved me more, she wouldn't be doing that. That's all. It doesn't take any more than that to start the whole thing. Then I could follow with, since she is doing that, she doesn't love me more. That's because she doesn't love me enough. Why doesn't she love me enough? Et cetera, et cetera. What's wrong with her? What's wrong with me? And now I'm unhappy that she's making me feel that I can't motivate her, that there's something wrong with me, and all I want is the simplest thing, which is whatever. Now this can be also, remember the sentence starts off, if you loved me, you would. That's for person number one. For person number two, it's the second frame of reference we were talking about, the same thing. If I loved you more, I would have. If I loved you more, I'd feel such and such, or if I loved you more, I'd do this or that. What's the matter with me that I don't love you more, etc.? Why don't I love you enough? And that whole same reasoning could continue using myself as the one I'm expecting something from. Now, the whole dilemma is based on the belief that my wanting you to be happier should make it so. Right? Because I'm saying, if you were happier with me, you would do such and such a thing. So it's all based on the belief that my wanting you to be happier should make it so. The myth that I should be able to motivate you to overcome every fear and hang-up you ever had is basically what we're talking about. Okay, I should be able to motivate you to overcome every fear and every hang-up you ever had. And you'll find that this is usually what the parties are saying in a relationship that they're unhappy with. I had a patient that reasoned like this. My mother is afraid of mice. If she loved me, she would not be afraid of me if I dangled a mouse at her. That may seem patently absurd to you, but that is what you'll find some variation of in any relationship that you find is in trouble. My mother is afraid of mice. If she loved me, she'd not be afraid of me if I dangled a mouse at her. So he dangled a mouse at her. She got frightened, then she got angry, and he was satisfied that he had proved that she didn't love him at all. And he was very satisfied. He was sure he now had proof that she didn't love him at all, or at least not as much as he needed. This model, although it's extreme, I think you'll see You can fit anything into it. So-and-so is afraid of such-and-such. So-and-so is threatened by such-and-such. My husband, my wife, my children, my parents, whatever. If they really loved me, they would not be afraid of such-and-such if I did it. When others fail our test for love, this test being, if you loved me more, you would, etc., we believe that we have seen evidence that we're unlovable, or evidence that we're not worthy of being loved, or evidence that we're not good, or evidence that we're really unable to motivate others. It's all basically the same evidence. This is true. We have seen that evidence. And yet, in a sense, it's not true. What has happened is that we have basically really discovered the reality of human relations dynamics. That's all that's happened. When others fail our tests for love, all that has happened is that we have discovered the basic reality of human relations dynamics, which is this. People love only to the extent that they are happy. This correlation is so exact, it is in fact not a correlation at all. People love only to the extent that they are happy. That's all we ever find out when we test love. We only find out that people can only love to the extent that they're happy. And this is not really a correlation. It's so exact. It really is, love means happy with. Okay? Love means happy with. And that's what we discover. If we are or do what others are afraid of, to that extent, they cannot love us. That's all we discover. That if we are or do what others are afraid of, to that extent, they cannot be happy with us. People can only love what they are happy with. Now, we could say, you know, like, if they are usually happy with us, then I think we can easily say they are usually loving us, and vice versa. If they are usually unhappy with us, then they are usually not loving us, because they're really one and the same thing. If we are or do what others are afraid of, to that extent, they cannot, absolutely cannot, love us. They are mutually exclusive terms. One cannot be afraid of and love at the same time. I do want to point out something we'll get into later. That doesn't mean they can't want to love us. It doesn't mean that they don't want to love us, which is usually the confusion. But they certainly cannot love us at that time. The problem with discovering this dynamic is that we believe it is something to be unhappy about. When I have discovered that I can scare other people, and to the extent that I scare them, to that extent they can't be happy with me or love me, I think that I have found out something for me to be unhappy about. Why? Because we believe this. That it's something to be unhappy about, to the degree that we believe we need another to be happy with us. So that if I discover that basic dynamic, that people will not be happy with me and cannot be happy with me if I scare them, that bothers me because I believe I need them to be happy with me. The only problem I think I have ever seen in relationships The only problem I think I've ever seen in relationships is that people will not allow others to be unhappy. I want to add, we have all kinds of ways of not allowing others. All kinds of ways. They're as varied as attacking them or leaving them alone. And everything in between. From ignoring them, attack them. If we want another to be happier for whatever reason, that's one thing. If we want another person to be happier with us for whatever reason, that's one thing. But if we need them to, we are resorting to trying to motivate ourselves with unhappiness, right? If we need another to be happy with us, what we're really doing is resorting to trying to motivate ourselves with unhappiness in order to motivate the other to be happier. Then we may try to motivate the other in one of two ways. Okay? So once we need someone to be happier with us, we'll try to motivate them in one of two ways. One, by giving what they, quote-unquote, need or want, by giving that to them, like, you know, really being nice and giving, generous, etc., or by denying it and depriving them of what they need or want, hoping to motivate them by unhappiness. So what it breaks down to is that we'll approach it one of two ways, hoping to motivate them by happiness or hoping to motivate them by unhappiness. But there's a built-in pitfall in either of these, a seed of destruction in either of these approaches that they can't succeed if it comes from our own need. Anything that we may do to get someone to love us from our own need is doomed to failure. It is impossible for it to succeed if our approach is from our need to the degree that we need. In the first case, the case where we decided we need it, we're going to try to motivate the other person by giving them everything and removing fears, etc., we come to feel that we are catering and placating if we use the first approach. If I feel I need someone to love me, and what I'm going to do about that is to, you know, just give them everything they want, I'm going to feel that I'm placating and catering, and that eventually we're going to feel that we have to continue this behavior or we will not get what we need. We're going to feel that we have to, that we must. It's going to become a feeling of a should. We eventually resent the other's need. We eventually resent them for having their fear. We resent them for having their need that we keep catering to. And we wind up only realizing that we were confirming our original fear in the first place, which is, you will only love me as, you will only love me as long as I do this or that, which was my original fear. You will only love me as long as I'm, and only if I'm generous, kind, patient, always looking the other way, never criticizing, or whatever. Always bringing home the money, never yelling at the children, whatever that is. That's the only reason you love me. And we wind up not feeling loved at all, because the other person is only happy conditionally. And we encouraged that, and we played with that. And we never really dealt with it, we just kept them happy conditionally. The other approach by which we try to motivate the other, the one which we call by making them more unhappy, that's the second one, to motivate them. In trying to prove that if they need, they will never get from us what they are unhappy. They will never get from us what they're unhappy about or while they're unhappy. We try to prove to them that if they need us or need something from us, that they're going to be making us unhappy, which of course was their fear in the first place. So we punish them. And this is very much like training a person, training, quote unquote, training a person to not need anything from us with the hope that if we succeed, they can't be unhappy with us, because we could never fail them then. So if I could train a person by making them feel very bad anytime they've ever needed something from me, every time I've ever disappointed them, and somehow punish them for that, my hope would be that I would train them not to need anything from me. And so then if they don't need anything from me, I can't fail them and they can't be unhappy with me. And both of these approaches begin with an absolute terror of anyone being unhappy with us. That is the thing that is just not allowed, which is what I began with in the first place. That's the problem with the relationship. We just cannot allow people to be unhappy with us. And we'll resort to any extreme to do it. We'll either sell out and sacrifice everything and deprive ourselves and constantly give, 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 and build up feelings of resentment. Or we'll do just the opposite and try to show them that we'll give nothing. And we'll just give them more misery, more unhappiness and anger, et cetera, et cetera. Until they learn. Until they learn to stop being unhappy with us. Both of these approaches only continue and increase unhappiness. They never solve anything. If truly adhered to by both parties, if these approaches were truly adhered to and stuck to rigidly, in other words, to an absolute degree, it could lead to death within hours or minutes. Taken fully to its extreme, each person believing that, they would kill each other, and they do. Most times, though, with people, they'd rather give up the relationship. They'll kill the relationship instead of killing the other person. They'd rather give up the approaches, and rather than give up these approaches, I should say, rather than change their approach at all, or change their basic belief, they'll kill the relationship. In counseling people with these difficulties, if you want to call them difficulties, the new belief that can make the crucial difference, and this is the one that I was referring to when I said that it was both true and untrue about being unloved and unlovable. The new belief that can make the crucial difference is that one did not really prove that they are unlovable or unloved. They only proved that they knew how to confront and tap the other's fears. That in a relationship, no matter how you try to test love, you are never proving really that you were unlovable or that you were unloved. All you prove is that you know how to tap another person's fears. That's how it's not true. But this is how it is true. In a sense, it was proved that that one wasn't loved more or enough at that point. But a person wouldn't be unhappy if they had another corollary belief to go along with that. So that when the person says, you know, it proves that I'm not loved, this proves that they don't love me. You could point out that doesn't prove that they don't love them, it only proves that the other person's afraid. And yet, in a sense, it does prove that at that moment, at that place, in those circumstances, they can't be loved because the person is afraid of them. If they had this other belief that went something like this: although I am not loved more at this moment by so-and-so, although I'm not loved more at this moment because they are scared, I have not proved that they do not want to love me more. And that usually is very, very consoling and peace-giving for a person to realize. Although I think I may have proven that they don't love me more, and I've proven really that they're afraid, and because they're afraid they don't love me more, that doesn't prove that I'm unlovable. It only proves that because they're afraid they can't love me more. It doesn't prove that they don't want to love me more, that in fact they're against loving me more. And I guess the question we could ask ourselves is, can we ever really find proof that another person wouldn't want to love us more? Who is there that wouldn't want to be happier? Who is there that wouldn't want to love anybody more? Who is there that wouldn't want to love us more? Now, you will find that there are different answers to that question. In a sense, sometimes you will find people do not want to love other people more. Strangers, people they don't know. They find that very hard to do, or almost impossible to do, with people they do know. So that a person who really doesn't want to love people more has got to keep themselves from knowing them. But once you're in a relationship and you're dealing with people who are already in this relationship, this would be the question. That other question we could deal with at another time. But in that relationship, who wouldn't want to love the other one more? Who wouldn't want to be happier? So we could see this for ourselves. They would want to love us more, and they would love us more if they believed they could. It doesn't prove that there's anything wrong with us if the other is not able to overcome all their fears instantly. If the other people we love are not able to overcome all their fears instantly regarding us or other people, it doesn't prove that there's anything wrong with us. They certainly would want to overcome those fears if they believed they could. But all the unhappiness that we have with them is based somehow on the belief that because of who I am, they don't even want to overcome their fears of me. They don't even want to love me more. Somehow, because there's something wrong with me, they don't even want to love me more. And that's where all the anger and the unhappiness and the depression in relationships come to. And the confusion, I think, stems from this. In our emotions, and in our language, in fact, we often believe that loving and wanting to love are identical. And we could say to somebody, I love you. But we could really mean two things. We could mean I love you, or frequently what we could mean is I want to love you more. You know, I'm happy with you, or I want to be happier with you. And both of those we express in our language by saying to somebody, I love you. We could be angry at somebody and having a terrible argument with them, and somehow in that argument saying, yeah, but I'm only doing this because I love you. They're saying, they don't mean I'm happy with you right now. They can't possibly mean that. What they mean is, I want to be happier with you because I love you. That kind of an answer means, I want to be happier with you. I'm not happy now, but I want to be happy with you. So very frequently, we do confuse them, and I guess it's because we know that what we basically want, really, is for the person to want to love us. The fact that they do or do not love us at any given moment would not matter to anybody. Would never matter to you, as long as you believe that someone wanted to love you. And that what was preventing them was their own past, their own beliefs, their own fears, not you. On close inspection, it seems that what all people really want from others is for them to want to love. If we know that a person sincerely wants to love us, we cannot be unhappy because we cannot believe it's our fault. And I think from all the things that we've said in previous weeks, you can understand that we can only be unhappy when we believe that it is our fault, that there is something wrong with us. We cannot be unhappy when we don't believe it's our fault. We cannot be unhappy. And people in a relationship cannot be unhappy with each other if they really saw that the other person was being unhappy and frightened and was indeed wanting to love them, but felt that they weren't unable to. And if you think of all the counseling and all the people you've ever known, and maybe even in your own lives, all the unhappinesses that people have and all the complaints, you'll find that they're all based on that fear. If you ever had that fear, it was the fear that somehow the other person didn't even want to love you. Not, you didn't believe that they were trying with all their might. You didn't believe that they were doing everything they knew how to do and everything in their power to be happier. And you really believe they don't even want to be happier with you. And so we can go back and change that whole thing. If you really wanted to be happier with me, and if you really wanted to love me, you wouldn't do such and such a thing. See, instead of if you loved me, what's meant by in that sentence very frequently, it's not if you loved me, you would do such and such a thing. Because I really do know that when you're scared, you're scared. But what I'm really saying, I suppose, when I say if you loved me, I'm saying if you really wanted to love me more. And that's why it's an impossible sentence. That's why I wanted to share with you, like I said earlier, that it's really an impossible sentence filled with contradictions. Because we can't accuse somebody of not wanting to love us more in any real way. We can't accuse them of not wanting to be happy. Not wanting to be happier. And if we can be in touch with that, and if our unhappiness with another person is based on the belief that they don't really want to be happier, we don't have to believe that. Because it's impossible for another person not to want to be happier. So that hinge belief, that cardinal belief which is behind all the problems in relationships, which states itself, if you loved me more, you would be such and such a way or do or feel. Can't really be seen if the person is able, can't really be believed and felt if the person is able to see. And later on tonight, I'll share with you some cases, or at least one if we can get a chance, about how this bears itself out, you know, in a counseling situation and how we can go about dealing with it. Okay, so that what I really want you to see is that how it's all based on that one belief, and that difficulties between people, no matter what shape, no matter what form, no matter what style, no matter what the roles, can still be boiled down to this very, very simple principle. If you loved me more, or if you really wanted to love me more, you would, etc. And just by sometimes pointing it out, as we do for ourselves, how many times have our own problems with people stopped when we've said to ourselves, they don't really mean to be that way. They didn't really mean to say that. Or they don't really want being that way. How many times have they stopped when we saw that they were really very sorry and felt very bad? Why did we enjoy their feeling bad about having been? Because it was their way of saying, I don't really want to be this way either, and I didn't really want to treat you that way. And when a person is very apologetic and falls all over you, why do you even allow that to let you feel good? Because somehow they're saying, but don't you see, I really do want to be happier with you, and I don't know what came over me, and I don't know what happened, and I don't know why I'm this way, and I don't want to be. And as long as they reassure you that they do want to love you, all is forgiven. If you really believe that they really do want to love you, it really doesn't matter what they do. I've seen people, well, again, I'll get more into it later, but I've seen people that lived in what you would consider the most impossible situations with alcoholics and drug addicts, and could really love those people and be with them very much when they realized that. I didn't speak too much about, I notice now that I didn't speak too much about the second person who was unhappy about not being what they should. But basically all the dynamics are the same. That's the way of motivating themselves to be what they'd like to be in the relationship, to do what they'd like to do.
Are you saying here that that second kind of reaction is that if you aren't what I want you to be, there must be something wrong with me again? That I can't give you whatever you
right.
need to be what I want you to be.
Right. Exactly. And there must be something wrong with me that I can't motivate you, that I can't. And that person is very much in touch with it. And they feel like, you know, I really don't love that person, I guess. But how come they feel so bad about it? Because again, they're confusing loving and wanting to love. They're not in touch. But they do want to love, and that's all that's needed. All you need to have a good relationship is to want to love. You don't need to love. You need to be happy. You just want to be. Now, that isn't really needed because that's there. And a person who's very frequently the withdrawn party, or the abused party, or the victimized party, or the masochistic one, whichever one you want to call it in the relationship, is very frequently feeling that they don't love the other person. And they feel bad about that. I try my best. I don't know what to do. I can't feel any better about her. I can't feel any better about him. That kind of a thing.
Like if Marvin were very unhappy with me, and I...
Let that be okay?
Let that be okay. I was thinking, well, then I might miss out on being with someone who would just be happy with me.
Exactly. We could still let it be okay, and then we just only may find out that a person who's very unhappy with us all the time, in a sense, is just not there for us. Mm. And I think it becomes easier and more possible for it to see, and also for that person who's unhappy, it becomes easier and more possible for them to see that when they're being unhappy, and if they're being unhappy, that's okay. But that doesn't mean that we like it or we love it. We want to love them, but we will never want to love their unhappiness. And especially because we love them, we won't want them to be unhappy. So we don't have to be unhappy with another person's unhappiness. We can see that. Okay, now what happens if we're not really unhappy with their unhappiness? We really aren't. We won't be avoiding them, but I don't suppose we'll be searching them out either. it would be impossible for us to look forward to being with them too. But that's all right, that is not a problem. Very natural resolutions come about in that respect. And the person who's very unhappy is just very unhappy and isn't going to really, you know, be any different regarding you anyway. And what becomes possible, I think, at those points, when the unhappy person can really see that all they are doing is depriving you of a friend, they don't really want to do that necessarily, and all they're doing is depriving themselves, they're able to get more in touch. At least they're not feeling that they're doing something horrible to you. They will be able to see that they're self-defeating, I suppose, because you won't keep getting in the way and telling them what their real problem is that they make you unhappy, when indeed their real problem is making themselves unhappy. Yeah, I guess we use it in order to be selective who to be with. As I said earlier, you can't love when you're unhappy. If Marvin was nothing for you because he was unhappy, then he'd just be nothing for you. It'd be nothing for you to run away from, but nothing for you to be attracted to, and it would just be as if there was a noisy vacuum in your house. In a sense, the person would be a vacuum. Hardly a person, hardly there, hardly anything to attract another human being, but not anything necessarily to repel them, and they would be being what they wanted and felt they needed to be. Now, if you had some reason, as I pointed out earlier, if for whatever reason you wanted them to love you more, that's another problem. That's another thing, and that's no problem, really. That's another story. If you wanted them to love you more, then you could easily do it. You could easily help them. You could try to help them. And they could see that you didn't need them to love you more. They were an unhappy person. You would like them to be happier. You would want them to love you more. You would want them to be more happy with you. But you would approach that thing a whole lot differently. And probably in such a way that would make a real difference to that other person. Because they wouldn't be able to use you as the thing to hang their unhappiness on. And that although they may be unhappy about everything else, they wouldn't necessarily want to bring that into your relationship. And they'd probably be quite willing to suspend their unhappiness when they're with you. And you may find that eventually they'd only want to be with you when they were really happy. So they could have that, and they'd want to be with you, and they'd be happy, etc. And it would change things quite a bit. Is there anything unclear about this?
Easier life, a less painful life, maybe more desirable than a more difficult life. It is a possibility, and I'm wondering if happiness really has any, happierness really has anything to do with why I might desire more money or to work less hard or to have
it certainly
an
would.
Automatic ice maker in my refrigerator instead of opening ice cubes.
Unhappiness or happiness certainly would if you were aware of the desire. If you just simply tended toward an easier life, then we would say, okay, then you just tend toward an easier life and that's what this kind of human being does. But if you've got a reason for it, the whole concept of reasoning is what we mean by happier. That is, whatever reason you give to things, that's what you mean, you're happier. By definition, that's all.
Okay.
See, so that as long as you're in touch with, it is more desirable, you must mean and have to mean in some sense that you'd
be happier.
Yeah. Now, if you were just simply tending toward it, not aware of its desirability, see, you don't have to desire something if you're doing it. You only desire it as a reason to do it. And I think you're desiring, what you're talking about desire, is just stating a fact. You've already tended toward it. And it may be true that the whole concept of happiness and unhappiness is invented to have reasons. But there's no reason to believe you'd tend toward easier as opposed to harder, because
Right. Built
into those definitions of easier and harder are all kinds of judgments. What's truly easier, what's
true. Truly
harder. You know?
But those judgments need not have anything to do with happiness. They might have to do with some other value system that you said, that if there is desiring and moving towards, then
it's not a value system. It would have to
happiness.
Do with no value system, is what I would say.
Right.
Not has to do with another value system. Not that there's anything else to replace happiness and unhappiness. that just isn't there, and that's all. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to replace it. It's just not there, you're just due, you're just being, you know. We may put on shoes because we say it's easier, and we're not doing it to be happier, it's just easier mobility, etc. But, is it?
In the winter it is, because your feet stay warm.
Why do you live in a cold climate? Is that easier to live in a cold climate?
Is it easy to live in a cold climate? Yeah, if you're already in one.
Do you see what I mean? So then you make all kinds of definitions and judgments, etc. Maybe you wouldn't stay in a cold climate if you would really wanted to do the easier thing. And as the sun started going south, you'd start going south.
You might not have enough money to go south.
Reasons. Again, reasons. And all because of something to do with happiness or unhappiness. Perhaps if you were completely devoid of that, you would migrate like animals migrate. Other animals migrate. Without reasons. And the bear may not have a reason for going into the cave in the winter. That's just what bears do. Those that do it, do it. We say that they survive better because of it. Sure, well, the ones that survive better are the ones that we're going to see. Very frequently, we view ourselves with a teleological, you know, approach. We say that, you know, roses need thorns for their existence and protection. It's just not so. It's just that the roses with thorns are the ones that have survived. Roses without thorns didn't survive. In an evolutionary sense. And it's not even to make the judgment that some rose made some judgment that it's better to survive.